An Australian river conservation group has hit the jackpot, winning an international prize worth $500,000. The Lake Eyre Partnership has taken out the International River Prize for its efforts in saving the iconic Cooper Creek. The group formed in the 1990s in opposition to the growth of the cotton industry on the Cooper in Queensland. Partnership spokesperson Professor Richard Kingsford says the prize recognises the whole-of-community approach to balancing the needs of the environment with the economic and social needs of community.
What makes this so different is they've never awarded a prize ever in the history of the River Symposium, the River Prize, to protecting a whole river system. Every other prize has been essentially awarded to people who are trying to rehabilitate rivers. They're real basket cases, and governments have had to spend huge amounts of money. Last year, the Rhine won, and they were spending billions of euros to restore the Rhine. So this is a real sort of example of prevention being better than cure, and I guess that's a real message that comes out of us winning this. And the River Jordan, huge problems. I mean, obviously, this was a partnership between the Jordanians, the Israelis and the Palestinians, and so all of that conflict, and they have a river that's, you know, it's water quality so bad, the sewage going into it, and not much of it's getting to the Dead Sea, and you know, they were just trying to get a little bit of better water quality and some environmental flows. So quite different on so many fronts to you know, the Lake Eyre Basin.
And the Lake Eyre Basin is a community approach to conservation and the balance between conservation and development in the Lake Eyre Basin. How vast is the Lake Eyre Basin?
Look, the Lake Eyre Basin is about a sixth of Australia. It's over 1 million square kilometres. It's pretty similar size to the Murray-Darling. Most people probably know more about the size of the Murray-Darling Basin. And right across there are landholders, there are tourist operators, there's oil and gas exploration, there are towns like Alice Springs, Longreach, Winton, Innaminka in South Australia. And obviously the two big river systems that go down through here is the Cooper, where the Thompson and the Barcoo join to form Cooper Creek, and then the Georgina Diamantina. And then there are some western rivers that come in from the NT, and they sometimes make it, like the Todd River will eventually make it into Lake Eyre. Lake Eyre fills very rarely, but it does get water more often, maybe every 2-3 years. So that's what we're talking about, and we're talking about an amazing community, a very remote community, lots of Aboriginal communities who are very engaged with the rivers, and then lots of landholders who gain their livelihood. I mean, they depend on these rivers.
Why were you formed? Because I think it was been when there was a huge debate about whether there should be irrigation on the Cooper Creek for cotton production.
That's right. And there was also at the same time a lot of discussion about World Heritage. So the two things that happened was, first of all, World Heritage nomination for the South Australian part of the Lake Eyre Basin was being talked about. And about that time, there was some irrigators from the Murray-Darling who came to Windora and bought up a couple of licences there and said they were going to grow. Well, they didn't actually specify, but I think most people thought there was probably going to be cotton. And that really was a catalyst to not only the local community, but they were very active and they engaged with scientists around Australia who were working on rivers and damaged rivers. And I remember getting a call. I was out on the Paroo actually working in 1995, and I got a call and said, look, you know about impacts of building dams and taking water out of rivers. We'd like you to come to Windora to a workshop. And so we had that workshop on the banks of the river. Actually, you know, in Windora, and we discussed the river and we discussed what the damage was, and people were invigorated by that.
Was the state of health of the Cooper Creek and the Lake Eyre Basin at that stage? Because at that stage you were really focusing on the Cooper Creek, I suppose.
That's right. And the Cooper was very good condition. You know, it's still doing its floods and its dry periods. There'd been a big flood in 1990, there was a big flood and it was going through a dry cycle. But the question was, you know, how much water could you take out of this river? And there was a discussion about only taking 1% of the average flow. But that's ridiculous talking about averages in these highly variable systems. It's like talking about average house prices in Sydney. You've got to think about medians if you're going to do that. So there's a lot of debate about all of that. And I guess people started talking to other people living on rivers. So the people of the Cooper started talking to the graziers on the Macquarie Marshes, for example. And there was a connection there, and they were saying, you know, this is what's happened to us. We thought this was not going to have much impact, but we've seen the transfer of wealth up from our grazing properties up the river to irrigation. And, you know, and then there were people from the Condamine Ballon, which was the last major river to be developed in the Murray-Darling. And people said, well, this starts slowly. You know, there are a couple of people start irrigating. Then there's political pressure and there's money coming out of an area and more water gets given out. And before you know it, in the Condamine Ballon, I actually believe we lost a river in 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of that was being discussed and it was influencing governments and governments were listening, and the Queensland government completely changed its water plan at the time. It was a water allocation and management plan. It was called a WAMP. And the question was, why call it an allocation one when there's no allocation in this river? And they turned it into a water resource plan because they said, we want to manage the, we're not making any decision here about giving out water. We realise that actually water is providing a whole lot of ecosystem services. You know, all of these people in the Channel Country depend on that water for growing organic beef. They depend on it in South Australia for fishing. And increasingly in the Lake Eyre Basin, we're seeing that these rivers are driving an exponential growth in tourism.
What do you feel the real achievements have been over the last 20 years since the formation of the Lake Eyre Basin Partnership?
Well, I mean, one real achievement is the river is still flowing the way it's always flowed. Mm-hmm. That is a real achievement. There's pressure all over the world on water resources, and they're still doing that. The second achievement is I think we've got a really coherent, cohesive focus on what are the big issues in the Lake Eyre Basin. It's an opportunity, and governments know they're getting straight advice about the whole system. And I think, really interestingly, we're starting to get into a program of linking better the vision for the basin through to NRM management and science on the ground. So what we actually want to invest this money in is connecting to the programs on the ground.
So what is your budget?
We won the national prize last year, $200,000, and we won this international prize this year, $500,000.
So what are you going to do with the money?
So we're going to start having these programs. We've currently got a whole lot of on-ground projects in each of the regional bodies. Some of them are looking at waterholes, some are looking at prickly acacia, and then we're going to try and work out how do they those programs link up to the vision for the basin. And then for each of those programs, we're going to try and work out what's the science that says, you know, when do we need to manage this? What are the thresholds? What we call the thresholds of potential concern. So, you know, at what point do you need to start really managing for cane toads or goldfish in this system? And can you manage for them?
And what? How will the $500,000 assist you in doing that?
So the $500,000 will essentially be about consultation and forming an overall framework that knits together each of the programs in each of the parts of the basin. And it'll be community consultation. It'll be how do we link the science better to what people and what is the science that we need to invest in this system.
Richard Kingsford, you mentioned the vision for the basin. You mentioned the sometimes conflict between development versus conservation. What are the challenges as you see them if you're going to keep the Cooper Creek in a viable state, a sustainable state?
Look, I think always the challenge about water is there's no free water around there. So if you're taking water from a part of this basin, it's going to have an impact. The question is, so, you know, people talked, and the last Campbell Newman government was trying to promote irrigation in the Cooper, for example. Now, the problem was, they were saying only small-scale irrigation. The problem is, as soon as you start taking water out, means there's less water to get down through those water holes, less water to get into South Australia. So this is always going to be an ongoing discussion. There will always be people who want to use water more productively. And the debate will be about, well, what's your definition of productivity and what's the sustainability of it? The other major issue is really about what's the footprint of mining going to be in the next 5 to 10 years? How much water will mining be using. In some places, there'll probably be excess water that the mining industry might want to connect back into the system. And I guess the other serious issue that people are concerned about is what's the physical impact of exploration and development on floodplains. So, you know, the Cooper, when it's in flood, has maybe an up to 80-kilometre wide floodplain. And what happens if suddenly someone finds a fantastic ore body there or coal seam gas there? How do we protect that intricate network of channels so that, you know, it's still doing what it's always done?
Richard, it looks like you've got another 20 years work ahead of you.
Look, it's exciting. I think it's fantastic. I love this place. I mean, I just...
What do you love about it?
I obviously love the environment, but I love the people. You know, just as much. I love going out there and talking to them and learning from them and understanding. Because, I mean, I don't have the luxury of being able to live out there. I sort of am a fly-in, fly-out person. But I love being with people who live there because they can tell me so much, whether it's landholders or traditional owners. Mm. They give me a dimension that my data can never actually get. I can collect the quantitative measures and so on, like numbers of water birds, but they give me the reality check.
Tell me a magic moment on the Cooper.
A magic moment is camping on the Cooper in a swag and just the noises. Because at night what happens is on these rivers, people probably don't know this, but a lot of water birds travel at night by the stars. And so you just have this constant traffic at night with pink-eared ducks twittering away, and they go up and down the rivers or on the lakes. And if you're there in a boom, you know, the frogs can be deafening. But I also love going back to the same place and it's never the same. Mm-hmm. It's always changing. So there's nothing dull about it.
Professor Richard Kingsford, who's the director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales and a member of the Lake Eyre Partnership. He was speaking with Robin McConkie. A bee research scientist from the CSIRO is calling for a different approach to land management to protect bee populations. Dr. Saul Cunningham has won the 2015 Australian Ecology Research Prize in recognition of his 20 years studying the role of bees in crop pollination. The prize for mid-career scientists is awarded annually by the Ecological Society of Australia. Babs McHugh spoke with Saul Cunningham about the importance of both native bees and the introduced European honeybee.
We really want both. We want diverse, free pollination. And then in some systems that are highly, highly dependent on pollinators where you know, it really is critical to your bottom line, then sometimes you can't trust only to this wild group of bees. We actually need to pay to make sure bees are there at the right time.
If we take a look at the beekeeping system, would you say it is healthy?
Look, Australian beekeeping compares very well to around the world. We've got very good professional beekeepers in Australia, and we've got a few things that make Australia a good place to be a beekeeper. We've got fantastic food base. So the fact that we have forests of trees that produce big flowers, I'm talking about gum trees here, big flowers with lots of nectar and pollen. We've got a pretty good climate for bees. We don't have such a hard winter as you get in North America and Europe, for example. But then we're also free of a few of the most destructive honeybee diseases, in particular the varroa mite, which has had a terrible impact all around the world. So really Australian beekeeping is pretty healthy, but we need to do some work to make sure it stays that way.
And what work, that biosecurity or other things?
So biosecurity is your first defence, and keeping these diseases out of Australia for as long as possible is, of course, always a very sensible thing to do. But then some of the work we're doing now at CSIRO is looking more at strategies for keeping honeybees healthy, and it's part of this balance strategy where we say, on the one hand, we want to keep honeybees healthy, and at the same time, we want to keep diverse wild communities out there in the landscape and use them both.
And how do you work with these wild colonies? Or what needs to be done to support them?
My main message is to recognise that in our agricultural landscapes, you know, agricultural landscapes aren't, you know, primarily driven by conservation goals. We know that. They're primarily driven by production goals. But they still have bits and pieces of what we'd call natural or semi-natural landscape, and sometimes they're not even recognised. Even things like roadsides or the back paddock or, you know, the area under an isolated tree in a paddock. All our research is showing that all these little things, that they're not nature reserves, but they are patches of flowers and untilled soil. And those little patches are keeping these beneficial insects in the landscape. So they might be there in a way because we've sort of neglected them, but the fact that they are still in the landscape is really important, and we need to protect them.
Protect them how?
You know, we know that there's places in Australia where people are trying to remove what are essentially the last isolated trees scattered throughout the landscape, because those trees might create problems for moving large equipment, for example. My view is that we really need to try as much as possible not to be knocking out these last isolated trees. So there's keeping them where we can, and then where they exist is trying to keep them free of pesticides, trying to keep them from being invaded by weeds that are inevitably part of the landscape, trying not to, you know, till them if you're not really going to use them. These are not hard things to do. They're more a matter of being careful with how we use the land.
Is it fair to put this just on farmers? There's a lot of other land use in rural areas and increasing urbanisation. Should the message be going there as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm not trying to paint a picture that says farming is bad for bees. It's a picture that says we can support bees in those landscapes, and that's all land managers are responsible for those kinds of decisions.
Dr. Saul Cunningham, winner of the 2015 Australian Ecology Research Prize, and he was speaking with reporter Babs McHugh.